Mr. Chair, I am going to have to leave at 3:15 to go testify. I'll be back.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair. Good seeing you.
Good to see you too, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Perfect. We're opening up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today's February 1st, 2016. We have three things on the agenda. First, we're going to do a subcommittee orientation, and John's going to lead us through that. Then we're going to have two informational hearings, and we're going to take about 15 minutes with the Oregon State Library, and we're going to take 20 to 25 minutes with Department of Administrative Services. So why don't we start off with our subcommittee orientation. John, take it away.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. Just a couple of quick things on the orientation. Nothing new. We'll meet in here 3 to 4:30 on Monday and Wednesdays. We have eight full meetings scheduled. They're a combination of some budget requests and reports. All the materials will be on OLIS 24 hours in advance is what we're shooting for. The budget process is just slightly different. I'll explain the nuance for this session. The subcommittee will, if it chooses to report out budget items on the request, those items will be rolled into the budget reconciliation bills amendment and then go through probably capital construction and on to full. So there won't be any need to carry them directly to full from the subcommittee. There's normal policy bill posting notifications that are out there that you're aware of. 1 hour notice for the amendments, and amendments will be posted to OLIS. The two types of amendments that you need to be conscious of are those that are just posted as amendments and as proposed, and those that are posted as recommended. Budget notes need the co-chair's approval. And then out on the OLIS is a document for all of the agencies in the General Government Subcommittee. They're the legislatively adopted analyses of what you accomplished last session that shows, of course, the budgets, FTE, and other detailed narrative descriptions of agencies and their programmatic structures. So that's out there for you to review if anything comes up. And other than that, Mr. Co-Chair, the one item just to remember that this subcommittee, like others of Ways and Means, falls under the Ways and Means rules that were adopted this morning. Thank you. Perfect.
Any questions? Any thoughts? All righty. We're going to move to our informational hearing. Thank you, John. And we're going to open up our informational hearing on the Oregon State Library. Mary Kay, welcome.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Mary Kay Dahlgreen, and I am the state librarian. I appreciate this opportunity to update you on the implementation of House Bill 3523 and on our progress on our 2014-2017 State Library Strategic Plan. I'm going to start with House Bill 3523, which passed in the 2015 session and made changes to the State Library Board and the appointment of the State Librarian. It also directed the State Library to take the lead in purchasing subscriptions for state agencies and certifying state agency libraries and resource centers. Kind of the highlights of House Bill 3523 is the State Library Board of Trustees became the State Library Board. We had our first meeting on January 8th. There are now 9 members, and 7 of those members are specifically identified as 2 agency staff, 2 public librarians, 2 members of the public, and 1 academic librarian. The other new members are the Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction and the Director of the Commission for the Blind. Effective January 1st, 2016, the State Librarian shall be appointed by the Governor, subject to confirmation by the Senate. Although in the bill, the current state librarian may serve until July 1st of 2017. The most work we've been doing on House Bill 3523 has been the temporary administrative rules. We needed to wait to do the administrative rules because the bill called for the State Library Board to approve the administrative rules. And so we've passed temporary administrative rules, and we are working to get those permanently adopted by June. So they adopted the temporary rules on January 8th. essentially what we were doing was providing rules around the database and subscription licenses, eligible recipients of government information services, and certification of state agency libraries. In addition to addressing the administrative rules, we also eliminated some things that were no longer relevant. For example, copying charges, database searching charges, and mailing label making. And we also cleaned up some of the language. The current work that we're doing on House Bill 35.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I presume you had an advisory committee that was helping with this rule promulgation.
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, we did. And we have reconvened that group. They're actually meeting right now over at the State Library to work through the details of the permanent rules.
Have there been any issues that were raised as you went through rule promulgation? I mean, we've been working on this now for what, 5 years? It seems interminable. Have any issues surfaced?
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, there has been, I think, a robust discussion of the process.
That wasn't my question. Have issues surfaced? I don't want to know how vigorous the conversation was. I'd like a recitation of the issues.
The issues have been how to make sure that those subscriptions that need to go to the law library or to the archives, because they were not part of 3523. That has been a discussion of the Reference Coordinating Council, how to make sure that we streamline the process so that those will go to the correct agency. Another issue has been talking with agency libraries about how to certify the libraries, what that certification looks like.
Okay, follow?
Yep.
The things that we've talked about ad nauseum in this meeting are finding efficiencies, getting to yes on all of this. I'm looking to see what's the level of controversy. Are these rules going to pass? Do you have unhappy people? Have you found accommodation? Have you talked about, do we need all these libraries? Where is their collaboration? Those are the things, without me digging through your draft rules at this point. I'd like a report on how that's going.
Senator Johnson, I am confident that we will be passing the rules in June. We will be making some very slight tweaks to the temporary rules. We have everyone on board. As I say, we were having a meeting of the subscription group today, and Aletha Bonebreak, who is the chair of our board, was at that meeting. I asked her how it was going. She said, it's going very well. The other group that's working on the certification of libraries will be meeting, I think, next week. And I'm confident that we'll be able to move forward. And I'm also very confident that we will be making, in the full session 2017, I will be coming back to you with some of the efficiencies that we have created as a result of this.
Thank you.
So essentially, we've been, you can see the things that we've been doing. We've been gathering information, working with other organizations, and continuing to refine the rules and the processes. So let's talk a little bit about the 2014-17 strategic plan, which was created in August of 2014 by the State Library Board, and the State Library staff have been carrying out work on the plan since then. And we are essentially working on four strategic imperatives. Our first strategic imperative is focus on the customer. We have created customer service standards, and all staff was trained in December of 2015. One floor of shelving was vacated by June of 2015, and the funds that were saved on rent were used to purchase several electronic resources that have been requested by agency staff. One of those resources was Safari eBook, which provides a very wide variety of technical and professional eBooks, as well as webinars and recordings of professional conferences. In our work on...
Let's go back really quick. One bullet point back. Can you just take a few minutes and talk a little bit more about Safari eBook? You've had an opportunity to share it with me. I've had a chance to look into it. It's pretty cool. And so I think the committee needs to hear a little more about that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, co-chair.
Cool.
So the Safari eBook is essentially a conglomeration of publishers who have consolidated their e-books, and they're mostly academic publishers and technical publishers like McGraw-Hill and several of those of other publishers. And essentially what we are providing state agency staff is access to these e-books. And so they can be read on their desktop, they can be downloaded, and they're also, of course, all available to members of the legislature as well. I think that what we're really looking at with this product is moving away from the print sources that we have used and really moving into the use of electronic resources.
Thank you.
Does that help?
It's perfect.
Okay. So our enhanced partnerships strategic imperative, a couple of things really came out of the House Bill 3523 that are helping us with the enhanced partnerships. The legislation created the Reference Coordinating Council, shared database subscription purchasing and certification of agency libraries. All of those will help us allow us to reduce duplication. I'm sorry, I'm very dry. No, Sean, that's okay, Representative.
It's all right. Oh, you got your water.
Mm-hmm, thank you. I'm talking too fast, I'm sorry. So those are opportunities, huge opportunities for us to partner with other agencies. And as a matter of fact, we've been talking with both the Department of Transportation Library and the Dogami Library about some partnerships and some collaboration around digitizing resources. Another partnership that we're working on is the state's virtual reference service, AnswerLand, which was moved to the state library in July of 2015. Most Oregon libraries participate in this partnership, and we are now administering the program, and we have hired a permanent virtual reference librarian in October, and she is working to create efficiencies and to move forward with that particular partnership. One of our strategic imperatives is to build awareness of the state library. Often we are referred to as the best kept secret in state government, and my goal is to make us the worst kept secret in state government. One of the things that I think has been a very valuable to us is the closure of the reference room in October of 2014 has allowed my staff to go out to offices, go out into field offices to work directly with staff in state agencies to see what they're looking for rather than waiting for them to call on the phone. And the reference librarians are working on what's called embedded reference librarians, and essentially they've split up the agencies and they each are assigned to an agency. This has been done in academic libraries for a number of years, and so they'll work directly with those agencies. So when somebody comes to us and says, I have a question from DHS, I know which librarian to send them to. So I think that's really helping build the awareness. The other thing that we're doing is we are conducting a reputation audit. And this is being conducted, as a matter of fact, right now. And what we're looking at is, another way of putting that is a brand audit. We are looking to see, what do people know about us? What do people not know about us? And what do they know about our services?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
I don't know when we started all of this, let's figure out what's up with the state library, but it was biennia ago. You now have draft rules. It's in January. You're not going to adopt the complete rules, permanent rules, until the summertime. And yet you're doing brand auditing and out doing outreach. And what I'm curious about is how much of the foundational stuff that this committee has been so critical about for so long, how much of that is in the checked off list and completed before you start all this other stuff, brand auditing and visitations? I'm just trying to figure out, is the ship righted at this point as you're out trying to figure out what your reputation is?
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, yes.
Good.
We are functioning very highly. As I said, we are making some changes in our approach to reference services, and we are one of the ways that we can continue to right the ship is to do the kind of outreach that we've been doing, to find out what it is people are looking for, what people need, so that we can then keep the ship on a straight course.
Follow up.
Please.
Can you calculate at this point the savings? What's your head count? Has it dropped? Has your budget been adjusted by the efficiencies that you've found? How do you quantify all of this activity in a way that satisfies this committee that the library is being operationally managed?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I think that probably the best example of an efficiency is that we closed the reference room and we vacated one of the floors of shelving in the library. That saved us, I think it saved us about $70,000 a year. We are now able to purchase the Safari eBooks, which is a very expensive database, but to make it available to everybody across the state. And so we've been able to take the money that we saved and use it to provide better services.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Will there be a summary available to the committee about all of these managerial actions and quantified as to what they've resulted in savings, or is the $70,000 ostensibly the biggest piece of the savings?
Right now, Senator Johnson, right now, that is probably the most visible savings, the most visible opportunity for us to move from an old model to a new model.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I need to excuse myself to go testify. I'll be back.
All right.
Okay, so the reputation audit that we're currently conducting will provide the basis for an awareness campaign. Again, I think one of the things that the State Library has suffered under is people don't know that we exist, and agency staff don't know that we can provide services to them. So we are working very hard to make that happen. Our fourth strategic imperative has been to cultivate staff strengths. We have incredible staff at the State Library. Many of them have been there for a long time. We had the services of a DAS HR professional who helped us develop a performance management system that would move us beyond mere annual evaluation and would become a discussion between the manager and staff member each year that would be reviewed and discussed throughout the year. And that would include development plans and also, you know, their work plans as well. We are implementing that, and we're working to have everybody have that plan in place and everybody working through the process by July of 2016. My staff asked me if we could have a staff in-service day. Most libraries have staff in-service days. And so I have asked that the staff to create a staff in-service day. Mm-hmm. And we're very much looking forward to it. It will help us provide a larger context of the state and where the State Library fits in the state. And it will be an opportunity for the staff to participate in discussions about our next steps in implementing the strategic plan. So the objectives that we're working on right now, you can see up on the board here. So just to address what we're doing for each of these, improving customer satisfaction. Government Services is launching a customer survey that will address satisfaction with the services and products of the library. When somebody uses our services, a month after they use those services, we'll send a survey and ask them how we did. The BRAD audit will provide us with a baseline for increasing awareness of the State Library. We're refining our definitions of usage of the State Library. Circulation statistics are no longer enough. We need to look beyond that. And we will be bringing recommendations for new key performance measures to the legislature during the 2017 session. Our success in systematically purchasing subscription databases and certifying agency libraries will determine how much we create efficiencies. And by July of 2016, the staff will be fully engaged in the employee development process.
Perfect.
Questions?
Colleagues, any questions? Any thoughts?
We really appreciate your time. Thank you for this update. There's some good things going on. All righty. We are going to close the informational hearing on the Oregon State Library. We're going to open up the informational hearing on Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Department of Administrative Services is here to report on administrative functions that state agencies provide for other state agencies. That would be non-DAS providing agencies.
Perfect. Welcome. So we're hoping, 25 minutes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. We will absolutely see what we can do in 25 minutes. I'm going to kick us off quickly, and then I'm going to slide out of the way. If you remember back to the last session, we had a fair amount of conversation about administrative services, how it's provided to other state agencies. We shared with you that we believe very strongly that DAS does not have to be the provider of services for a lot of different agencies. The purpose of this budget note was to do a survey out there and see what's going on, who's doing what, how do we adequately make sure that those costs are covered and the level of service is appropriate and that all necessary administrative functions are being taken care of appropriately. So I'm going to turn it over to Barry Pack and Pat Allen, who's the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services. They spearheaded this effort for us, and I think they've got a presentation that will have a fair amount of information for you. With that, I'll step back.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Barry Pack, Chief Administrative Officer with the Department of Administrative Services. We change titles as frequently as we change anything these days, it appears. Happy to be here today. We're gonna hit a couple of key points for you today, highlights from the research we did in response to the budget note, and then Pat and I will both be talking about some of the ongoing work that's happening in this arena of shared services and how the data from the report is helping inform some of that work. So we provided for the public the budget note text. I won't read it for you. You all remember what it was like. But I want to spend just a little bit of time here talking about what we found in the survey. First, it's important to know that the methodology we used was to survey agencies to ask either, are you receiving an administrative service, and we defined what those were, or are you providing them? Because we wanted to see whether there was any sort of disconnect. If people weren't paying attention that we were actually receiving it from some other agency, or that we were providing it to another agency. So we wanted to make sure we were getting on both ends. And then we asked for a staff person in the agency to be identified who is most familiar with how that service was being provided and how it was developed and arranged for. And then we actually sat down and did individual interviews with each of the staff who were involved to really try and flesh out how what was the need behind it, how that service sharing was arranged, and what sort of agreements were put in place. The responses in those interviews have been provided as part of our report to you. It's the big Excel spreadsheet that should be in OLIS. What we found is that there are 14 agencies that are providing a mixture of services to a total of 18 agencies. And there are a total of 24 different agreements or ways in which those services have been arranged between the two or three agencies. There are detailed interagency agreements for the vast majority of those. A couple of those arrangements are actually required by statute, so aviation having service provided by the Department of Transportation and the Office of Administrative Hearings getting their administrative support from the Employment Department are required by statute. There are two agencies that trade services informally, and those tend to be when there are workload issues or a vacancy and there's a need for some backup or some coverage. That's provided, but on a very informal, undocumented basis. And then one agency, the Department of Justice, who does work for the district attorneys without any real formal arrangement. It's just been the way they've done business for a long period of time. What we found is, like the full array of agencies, there's a full array of services that are being provided. Some are really discrete in the areas of HR or just payroll or just benefit management. Some is a larger suite of administrative services that would include finance and budget, procurement, all that sort of work. And then we were asking about cost recovery and found a similarly wide range of, in some cases, no cost recovery, either because they hadn't come up with the arrangement or the amount was so small that there was no, it was going to cost more to figure out how to come to that recovery model than it is to actually spend, to sort of informal estimates, if you would, about how much time and expenditure was being provided, to very detailed hourly, monthly, or annual rates that you might see from DAS, for instance. So a real wide range. And generally speaking, and as we get through this presentation, we'll show you, we'll walk you through how that sort of led to some additional research around sort of the scope of this environment of shared services.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Pack, you may well be getting to this soon, but are you going to comment at all about the size of the agencies? Because one of the questions that came up last year, you're nodding your head, I'll just let you go with it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, this is a great question, and I actually was assuming it was going to come up in a question, so I don't have a slide, but I'll answer it for you anyway.
Thank you.
I think there are a couple of major sort of themes or instances that we've observed in these arrangements. One is you'll have a small entity that is policy associated with a larger organization. So for Mr. Allen's agency, Construction Contractors Board receives services from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. There's a direct policy link there. The choice was made at the time not to create a separate administrative function there. You've got the Watershed Enhancement Board, or you've got aviation and transportation. You've got that kind of direct linkage. And in most of those cases, it's a larger agency supporting a small division or program. Then you've got circumstance of proximity. Mm-hmm. You've got the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Land Conservation and Development housed in the same building, working side by side, recognizing that they have peak workload needs that could be supporting each other, and coming to an informal agreement that they would supplement, agriculture would supplement and do HR work for the Department of Land Conservation and Development because it just made sense, and they could co-locate staff together and do that together. The third then is just I think developed out of the relationships that exist between agencies because they work closely together. Mostly we see this in the natural resource arena where the Department of Forestry during forest season, it's all hands on deck for the forest season, and we all chip in and help send staff to do some support work when that happens. But the other natural resource agencies that forestry has strong working relationships with is sort of a natural place to go.
Thank you. Mr. Pack, one of the things that I think the committee, certainly I was interested in, is the apparent disparity in the cost between the DAS's services and other agency services. And it appears from your report here that you found that at least some of the other agencies found that the cost of doing and providing that service was so de minimis they didn't even bother to charge for it, yet DAS charges an arm and a leg for it. So someplace in your dissertation, I would hope that you would address that issue of why does DAS cost so much when other agencies can do it for virtually nothing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we will get there.
Thank you.
So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Allen now.
Great, thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. In my spare time, I chair the Improving Government Steering Team, which you'll recall from past discussions and past sessions. It has been set up by the Enterprise Leadership Team and the Chief Operating Office to really run air traffic control over a variety of efforts across state government to try to improve how we do business, and particularly focusing on things that are operational in nature and really get at business functions. It's made up of a number of directors and chief business or administrative officers in the state, and we coordinate a variety of projects. What I'd like to do first is talk about specifically a couple of projects that are in this vein of what shared services look like, because I think they're useful to illustrate the kinds of things that we do. The first one is a shared internal audit project, and this is involves DAS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the Department of Revenue. And this is an example of a project where what we're doing is not sort of creating some kind of a merged organizational structure, but what we're doing is trying to merge a work plan that is very similar across three agencies around internal audits. For a couple of the agencies, DAS and DCBS, surprisingly large agencies have surprisingly little inherent audit resources. And so the ability to pool that work and look at common audits for common topics across the agencies and be able to do those together gets us a couple of significant advantages. We're able to standardize the way those audits occur, standardized findings, standardized methodology for conducting the audit. We're able to have staff do the same auditing work across multiple agencies. And most importantly, from my perspective, we're able to learn through that process from the other agencies in the audit findings, things that need to be addressed, best practices, those kinds of issues. So we're able to be more effective in the underlying mission of the agencies, as well as more effective in the execution of the audit. In a model like that, this isn't quite to your point, Senator Whitsitt, but it's kind of the same flavor. We're all doing the same quantity of work that we're doing. We're organizing it rather differently, and we're steering it differently. But that means there's no net cost difference, and so there's not a cost sharing or allocation or budget kind of an implication to that sort of work. Somewhat different from that, the next project is a pilot that we're conducting right now, having to do with payroll services between Department of Consumer and Business Services, Department of Justice, and Department of Revenue. Some of these agency groupings, if you were to look at them, you'll see Mr. Pack talked about affinities around policy or affinities around location. There's also sort of affinities around the nature of your business operations. In some settings, we kind of colloquially call these the 9-to-5 agencies. They're primarily office-oriented work where people come to a location and they do stuff in a standard business day. And that's a very different, particularly from a payroll standpoint, operational profile than agencies that have 24/7 operations or significant seasonal ramp-ups of staff or seasonal huge increases in overtime and those kinds of things. In this project, what we did is we physically took the payroll staff in each of these three agencies and have co-located them at the Department of Justice, and they form a single unified payroll shop that does the payroll processing work for the three agencies. This is also a good example of a project to talk about because, candidly, it's not going all that well. We're having some challenges with cultural issues and differences in work styles and those kinds of things. And I candidly bring that up to you because part of the part of what you do with pilots is figure out sometimes what you're piloting isn't going to work that well, or you need to change what your jumping off point for that pilot was and think of a different approach. And we actually think that means we're doing enough of these kinds of efforts. If every once in a while we get one that gets fairly rough sledding, we're being aggressive in how we look at that work. This pilot is yet a little different take on cost recovery because we're putting those people together in a single entity. I still have my payroll people there that I pay for. DOJ has their payroll people that they pay for, and so on. And so there's not a cost allocation. If that pilot continues in the form that it's in now and we get to the place that I expect that we would, where we start getting cost savings, simply put, somebody leaves and we're able to be more efficient and not have to replace that person, we would then have to start wrestling with the cost allocation that goes with that so that we appropriately allocate that. It's also a good project for getting into multi-agency governance of how do you decide the operational issues and resource issues and those kinds of things around a project.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. A couple questions.
Sure.
Going back to the internal audit slide, who is responsible for the oversight on these internal audits, and who is responsible for tracking the agency responses to the audit? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, are these audits, these interagency audits, as efficient and as complete and as good an audit as DAS is doing?
Yeah, Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, better, I would say, because they represent the accumulated knowledge and work of multiple auditors across agencies focused at each individual agency. So I get more people with more perspectives looking at a body of work in my agency, and I think I benefit from that. Each agency is required to have an audit committee, and what we do is merge the audit committees, and that's where the accountability of the agency responses and the oversight of the work and prioritization and all those sorts of things occur.
Okay. Second question then has to do with the next slide. So you've pooled your resources, and you said this might not be working out that well, but from the basic paradigm here, you've pooled your resources, and then you're no longer requiring any resource or oversight from DAS. Is that correct? HR.
Right. Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, that's right. But it's not so much no longer as we never did. These were all always self-contained operations, well, always, for a very long while, self-contained operations within each of our agencies that have an interaction with DAS in terms of the overall payroll system. But the payroll processing has always been native to each of the agencies. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. So basically, these three agencies, if this pilot doesn't work and you separate them back out, still would not be using DAS HR services.
Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, not necessarily. If this doesn't work out, one of the options on the table is to say let's simply have DAS pick up this function, and that's something that's been considered in the past, and mm-hmm. I think would be a live option for us.
I think you watch your pocket a bit closer than that, but go ahead.
Let's continue.
Yeah, please. So what I want to talk about, the last project that I'll touch on is this overall look that we're doing as an improving government steering team at the sort of the basic fundamental policy and definitional issues of these administrative services generally. There are common core administrative and business services that all agencies in some fashion have, and those are, you know, not obvious things that you can see up there: procurement, human resources, IT, those sorts of things. And there are some basic flavors of how they get done. And again, you can see them there doing your own using DAS, as we just talked about, or other agencies provide. I want to take just a second and talk about don't do them is an option that occurs, or don't do them very much. And I think if you really scratch down in very, very small agencies, you'll find that, in some of these entities where there's a staff of 2.5 or 3 people, the executive director, whatever the title is often responsible for a lot of what's on that list. And so you'll find that hours in a day being what it is, there's more or less of that being done. And so that's certainly a part of the mix. And then there's the notion of how agencies approach level of service, and this really does get at, I think, a big piece of one of the pieces of what Senator Whitsitt's talking about, where you talk about first how highly customized is a service, and how specialized is it to the kind of work you do, and so I'm going to just kind of pull out of my hat the notion of personnel investigations at custodial agencies, corrections, OIA, state hospital, are probably certainly of an utterly different nature than the kinds of personnel issues that I have in an agency where we're 9 to 5 in a work environment, as an example. There's also the notion of are they the kinds of things that are sort of transactional, that happen day in and day out and look fairly well the same, and are you in a financial world where you need to fully recover costs or not? Let me talk a little bit more about what that looks like. The project is trying to answer 3 basic questions. What's the minimum level of a shared service if it's happening? And can we come up to some standard definitions of that so that when we're comparing human resource services at agency X and those same services at agency Y, we're talking about the same thing? Are there standard ways to account for and allocate the costs across agencies? And that might mean, and what you'll see in a second, is there are some multiple ways to look at that, but however you're doing it, we ought to have some standard math. We're all counting the same stuff, and we're all dividing it by the same thing, and we're trying to do those calculations the same way. And the idea is for us to get to standards for if shared services are going to be provided. Here are the basic flavors that will occur in. Here's the standards that you have to follow to do that, and here's how you'll account for it. Now, that's not to say one size fits all, but it might be 5 sizes fits all or something like that, or whatever the number of sizes. They're all done. If you're on size 1 and someone else is on size 2, the agency doing size 1 is the same in every agency that's doing size 1, and the agency in size 2 is doing it the same way. We've done quite a bit of work to date on this.
Yeah, Madam Clerk.
Just to clarify, Mr. Allen, I'm not trying to be overly semantic here, but when you say size 1 and size 2, you really mean type 1 and type 2, because it could be the same for 2 different agencies at very different sizes, right? I just want to clarify.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I meant size like clothing or
yeah,
half
I got
size
it.
Or something,
I'm just,
like that.
I've
You're
been
right.
dealing with this on a couple other issues, and I want to make sure we're talking the same language here. Thank you, Mr. Allen.
I appreciate that. So what we've done is we basically took a catalog of services that DAS uses for customer agencies, and we went service by service across these broad categories down to the detail level and identified things like what is it you're delivering with that service? Is it transactional in nature? Is it strategic in nature? How does it work? What is it? So we could begin to build a common set of terminology around what these shared services are. And then we got into cost allocation and cost accounting. I'm going to come back and talk in a minute about some common methodologies that are out there now. But first, I'd like to turn it back to Mr. Pack to talk about the DAS methodology itself, and then we can compare and contrast and talk a little bit about some of these differences that Senator Whitsitt's observed.
Thank you. So, co-chairs, I'm going to apologize by saying we're going to go back a little bit in history to the rate and assessment conversations we had last session, and I apologize if it's repetitive, but it was instructive to us, I think, to take a look at. What we did with the Improving Government Steering Team is use Enterprise Human Resource Services as a starting point, because I think across all agencies, human resources is one that director-level people can really get our hands around. And we took a look at what DAS charges for HR. We have three primary charges. We charge for client managers, and these are people who actually are providing human resource services to other agencies. So they are the HR director for client agencies of DAS. We charge for the systems that those agencies and, in fact, all agencies use to support their HR work. And then we provide training opportunities, and we charge for those. In the case of client managers, it's a charge per FTE. In the case of the systems, it's a charge per transaction or per user. And in the case of training, the charge is per student or per course, depending upon the training. So we started to, then we said, okay, let's dive in here. What really makes up those rates? And it's relatively simple. It's the personal services cost of the people who are providing the service. It's the associated S&S that goes along with it. And one of the things that's important to note in there is the distinction between with data processing charges and state government service charges. They're built into DAS's rates. They're charged in different ways in other agency budgets because they're paying it. So it gets to be a little confusing, but there might be an agency that might be providing a shared service might have its own data systems that it supports on top of the charges it pays to DAS to pay for PPDB, for instance, the personnel database. We recover a portion of our overhead in the rates, and we try to build in a 60-day working capital of our cash. When you add all of that up, that essentially then equals the total need for the biennium to provide the service. You divide it by whatever unit, whether it's course or FTE or transaction, and that comes up with the rate. And then what we thought was really that could be the same for any service provided by any agency. The components are the same. It's the people doing the work, the money that supports them to do the work, the systems they need to do the work, some portion of overhead, and some portion of working capital to have a cash balance. Where the key comes is in coming up with standard definitions for all of that. So the difference, to partially answer Senator Whitsitt's question on some of these, cases of it costs DAS this much and another agency this much could be in how the definitions of what's in these rates are combined. How much of your administration are you recovering in the cost? How much do you have all of the systems that are in there? Do you have, you know, all of the working capital? Do you have different levels of working capital assumed in that rate? Until we can really come up with, as Mr. Allen had mentioned, the five sizes fits all, but with standard definitions, it's hard to compare and know that the costs include the same types of things in each rate.
Yeah, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Going back to a couple of slides in your what is the DAS EHRS rates, personal services between the DAS and another agency probably should be somewhat similar, assuming the classification of the employees. And allocation of business overhead probably should be in the same category. I'm not sure what the working capital, how that would work out, but it seems to me the major disconnect in what maybe some of the other, like DCBS is charging other agencies and DAS is charging other agencies, is in the data processing and state government service charge. And frankly, it comes to mind to me in DAS like a little bit like a $12 aspirin at a hospital. I mean, it's charges seem to get increased each biennium in a sequential and similar manner. And I never have been able to clearly understand what drives those costs. Why should a machine cost significantly more to run other than personal service part of running the machine? Why should the machine run more costly to run in 2016 than it was in 2010? I mean, that's where I think we should be. You know, I would hope you would focus some of your look.
Thank you, Senator. So then, I'm leading you through sort of the logic of the thinking that's been going on, and in part it's for some of these questions. The other element that helps determine cost is the level of service. So when you start looking at HR services, you have certain things that you absolutely have to do if you're going to run an agency. You've got to manage personnel records, your positions, your classifications, your compensation. You probably have to do some level of personnel investigations. You have to do recruitment to hire people into the positions in the first place, and then you have to train and support them. There are aspects of some of those that are purely transactional or are very common, and then there are pieces that are more strategic. There is more to recruitment than just posting a job opening in NeoGov. You've got questions around succession planning. You've got particular skill sets you're trying to attract. You're trying to diversify your workforce and reach out to different communities. That starts leading you into the more strategic business partnership aspect of human resources, and that changes the type of classification you need to do the work. So Senator Whitsitt is correct that largely the classifications are paid the same across agencies, but if you're providing a lower transactional level of service, you can probably do that with a human resource analyst one, for instance. If you want to really do the strategic business partnership where you've got those kinds of personnel investigations that Director Allen was referencing, you probably want an HR manager, a higher classification, doing that work. And so, again, off to the side of the slide, as you see, there's all the pieces that make up the cost of that service. But the level of service that you want to provide will also determine the cost, because it tells you how many people you need and at what classification to provide the desired service.
So let me take it back and talk again about the ways that agencies currently look at this allocation of costs. I'm going to talk very briefly, and then we'll wrap up, about four cost models. And these aren't particularly defined terms. They're the working terms we've used of full cost allocation, divisional cost, marginal cost, and no cost. And I'm going to talk about each of these for just a second. Full cost is really what we just talked about. And it's what I would say is the Cadillac of cost accounting. It's making sure that when you want to ask the question, what's the cost of your HR shop or something along those lines, you're absolutely, in fact, accurately accounting for every last nickel of the cost of what's going on there. You're accounting for the fact that they have to use a computer and the computer's plugged into the wall and there's a piece of the electric bill and there's a piece of the network administrator's time to make sure that computer comes on and all those sorts of things. And DAS, by nature of the way its budget works, absolutely has to be a full cost accounting model, because they need to be able to show all of their cost allocated out to the things they do and who pays for that work. Let's go on to the next one, which is divisional cost accounting model. And this is where you basically, I'll use HR as the example because my agency's noted here and I know about this example fairly intimately. This is where you take the cost of the function, and in this case it's HR, and you divide that cost up and you figure out that, well, it takes us about this much to do HR investigations and it costs us that much to onboard employees and those kinds of things, and you do a price list and you allocate it that way. We have a relationship right now where we do the human resources work for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we use this kind of a cost accounting model, and it's a real simple reason that we use this rather than full cost. cost. That structure came to be when we were in a very tight budget circumstance around as we were going into and dealing with the recession. And this was an opportunity for us to not lose valuable staff and have them do work for another agency that was advantageous to that agency that was losing some staff. And so it imposed no further cost burden on the rest of our agency, but it's not complete full cost accounting. I talked about full cost being the Cadillac. That doesn't mean it's the only correct. This is also a correct way to think about what the costs are. We allocate the costs of our shop across a different base of employees.
You would call that efficiency.
Well, yeah, but it's not full cost. I mean, I'm not charging today. And if I were to negotiate this deal today, I would probably negotiate it somewhat differently because circumstances are differently. And I probably would assign some overhead costs and those kinds of things to it. It was the right way to allocate those costs at the time to try to make sure we kept access to good staff. The third model is what we'd call a marginal cost model. And that's the sort of a thing where you're going to do work for an agency and you're going to need to add some sort of resource to be able to do that work, and you charge them for that resource. Again, it's a different way of looking at it than full cost accounting, but it's not necessarily any less accurate, or it's differently accurate, I guess, is the way to put it in terms of allocating that cost. And we've identified a couple of examples. The first one, the medical board and the board of dentistry, that's one of those sort of policy affinity kinds of areas where small to mid-size agencies that have issues in common with each other are able to share those costs. And then the last model is the no-cost model, and we've actually already talked about a couple of those examples, the payroll pilot and the audit pilot, where we're not changing nothing about each agency's cost and nothing about the total cost of the service is changing. We're simply organizing that work differently, and so there's not a cost allocation implication. Now, as I said, in the payroll project, if that project continues and works, it will begin to be less expensive to do that work, and we'll need to move away from a no-cost allocation model to some other model to basically fairly apportion those savings that occur if we continue down that road.
So I'll close here with sort of the next steps in this discussion. We are going to continue to use HR as the example, and we're going to work with agencies to develop some common levels of service. And the first place we start is really, what is that minimum level of service that every agency needs for HR? And then can we come up with some standard levels above that everyone can agree to, so a silver, gold, platinum level of service based on the business need? And then we want to take a look at these cost accounting models that we were talking about. And run a few samples through, and this will get to some of Senator Witsit's point. If we can run the DCBS model through the standard defined definitions for the various components of the cost and run it through the cost allocation or recovery methodology and compare that to the DAS rates, for instance, then we'll begin to understand really where the difference is. Is the difference that, you know, at the time, different negotiations left overhead and administration costs out of the recovery model? When you add that back in, it starts to look a lot more like what DAS charges. Or are the service levels different and the classifications of people doing the work different? Or is it they're just better at it and can do it more efficiently? We'll really finally be able to get an apples-to-apples look, is our hope. We'll run some samples through each of the various cost allocation models that Pat just walked you through, and then refine that as needed and see if we can come up with sort of this suite of standards that all agencies could use if they want to do this work. And then we'll move on to the conversation around governance. How do you oversee that? How do you hold agencies accountable that they're actually using those standard definitions and they're accounting for things the way that we've agreed you're going to do, and that they're actually having those kinds of levels of service?
I would just quickly mention on the cost accounting side, I'm really eager to see that information as well. Either I'm doing things that, if I'm accounting for them properly, cost more than DAS is, and I want to know why am I doing them myself, or I'm doing them and I'm doing them more effectively than DAS is, and I want DAS to do them the way I'm doing them. But either way, we get to a place where we make some kind of a change in our overall enterprise that rationalizes our actions to match what our costs are.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, I agree that enterprise budgets can be sometimes very enlightening and sometimes really disappointing. but I would say that the no-cost model is something more like a barter system where agencies are trading their services back and forth. Perhaps they're not large enough to require an entire HR position, so they're moving them back and forth. The marginal cost model appears to be based on efficiency. The divisional cost model appears to be based on subsidy, and the full cost model is just you charge for everything. I mean, would that be kind of a...
Yeah, Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, when I talked about not one size fits all, but four or five sizes fits all, I think that's really what we're getting at, is I think there are circumstances where each of those four models is the appropriate way to allocate costs. And I think what's important is that whenever we're using one of those models, one of the places we want to get is we're all doing the math the same way. So that if someone comes in here and you're curious about why agency this is doing that service for whatever other agency, you can ask them what's your allocation model and what's the service level, and you can pretty quickly understand why are they doing it and it doesn't. You can ask, well, why are you approaching that as a marginal cost thing when you've got all these other costs? Why aren't you allocating those? We can get to a place where we're all talking about the same thing. And I think that's part of why this has been such a thorny issue for a long while, is we're all talking about various variations on slightly different things on those topics, and it makes it very difficult to really all have the same understanding of what's going on.
All right. You're wrapped up.
We're wrapped, unless Perfect. There are other questions.
Is there any question from the committee? Any comments?
Brilliant testimony.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
I would just say, actually, I think this is a, first of all, thank you. This is exactly what we wanted from you. And of course, as usual with things like this, it probably opens more questions than it answers. That being said, I think as we try to work on this improving government stuff that DAS has been working on for a while and a lot of us believe in very strongly, it's exactly this level of nitty-gritty detail where we really understand what we're asking and where we're all starting to speak the same language. Only then can we actually make some real progress on developing efficiencies, on saving money, on making sure that what money we do spend is going toward its highest purpose. So I really appreciate this work a lot. I know it took a lot of effort, and I know it's going to take more. I'm actually pretty excited. I know it sounds like a really geeky thing to be really excited about, but I am.
Thank you,
you guys
Senator.
Know I'm a geek. What can I tell you?
Thank you. Paul, is there anything else we need to think about on this?
That's it.
All righty. We're going to close this informational hearing. And colleagues, that's all we have before us today. So I guess we're going to adjourn. Julie, are we good? Okay. We're going to adjourn.
Thank you.
Do we have floor?
Thank you.